Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Dr. Julie Helmrich. I'm a psychologist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you have made your way through the entire World Wide Web and wound up here at Shrink and Drink, the radio show. Thanks for tuning in. I have more questions than we're going to be able to get through today, for sure. So right up front, I apologize to people for... but. You know, number one, thanks for writing in. And number two, apologize, I won't be able to get to everybody today. I am clumping a number of questions together because they all relate to the murder-suicide that happened, the tragedy that happened here in the Milwaukee area yesterday. So I do want to answer those. And then there are a number of others that I will get to as many as I can, but probably most, they're just a lot, and so I won't be able to answer all of them. But I do want to take the one, get to the ones about the shooting, and I've clumped them all together, and I'm just going to read all of them, and then we'll try to kind of answer them collectively too. Psychologically, okay, first of all, this is about the shooter this weekend in Brookfield. Psychologically, why did this restraining order set him off? And why did he go to her work? Do they really want to hurt others, or do they just get in the way of bullets, not like just bad, like being just a bad shot? In other words, was he trying to actually... There were, as you know, I'll repeat the story for those people that are new to it. In a moment, I just want to read all the questions. Do people like this ever think of what it will do to the kids? Do people like the shooter have a plan, like going to kill the wife and kill self? I mean, why not just kill yourself? Why not put yourself out of misery? So anyway, those are multiple questions, and I'm going to try to give a general take on how psychologists usually think of these things. So first of all, for those listeners who do not know the story, and I do not profess to, I certainly have not studied everything that the media has put out on this, but I think the facts that I'm going to put out here now are pretty well agreed upon, which was that yesterday, an estranged husband to a spa worker went to the spa where she works and shot her and six other people, three of whom are confirmed deceased, and four who were treated. One yesterday, I think, was still in critical condition, three in satisfactory condition. I honestly have not this morning looked at the latest information, so I don't know how far behind the news feed on this story I am. And let's see, and he shot people with a gun, a 40-millimeter, I believe, handgun. And the story is that the town where he lived, I believe, that the police knew him because there had been domestic violence complaints, and they had obviously arrested him. There was a restraining order, temporary one put in maybe 10, 12, 14 days ago. I'm not sure exactly the date on that one, but a permanent one put in place last Thursday. And it was put in for 4 years. And if, I'm not an attorney nor a judge, so I don't know the exact, everything exactly around temporary restraining orders in Wisconsin, but I believe 4 years is the longest one you can get. So the judges, I think, have to have some decent evidence to decide that. And also the restraining order, the order was for him to turn his firearms into the police. That was a Thursday. Obviously, that didn't happen. At least not all of them were turned in. And there may be more information than what I just said, but that gets you the idea. So the first question, why did the restraining order set him off? Let me just broadly go into what is known about sort of murder-suicides. Sometimes it's mental illness, though not usually. And let me say that again. The mentally ill, people with chronic mental illness, are less violent than the average population. So though there will be many efforts, understandably, to try to understand why this guy did what he did, the odds are it's not going to, even if the media leans heavily into the idea that he had mental illness, the odds are still he would not have been determined by skilled diagnosticians to be any more psychologically troubled than the average person in our culture. That's just reality. Sociopaths also do this kind of thing, and they're not troubled at all by this. They're troubled by getting caught, and that's thankfully a very small percentage of any culture. And the odds are he was not a sociopath. And why am I saying that? Because unless he really had a vendetta against seven people, he wouldn't have been that bad of a shot, and he wouldn't have... This is going to sound kind of ugly, but it was too sloppy of an event for a sociopath. Sociopaths, remember, don't have empathy, so the, in quotes, advantage, unquote, that gives them in this kind of a situation is they're not troubled by their emotions. So they could be a little more cool, calm, and collected, which is part of what's so creepy, freaky, right, about sociopathic stuff. So who was this guy? This guy probably, odds are, probably normal, kind of a normal guy where the normality of his life just sort of implodes. The typical situation where there's domestic violence and somebody kills himself and their, you know, wife and sometimes kids is that their normal life just implodes. Sometimes there's money problems. Sometimes there are... money is, sometimes there's substance abuse in the picture, and that's not treated enough. Sometimes, sometimes there are workplace issues. In other words, you know, take your worst day and take it times 15. Doesn't mean you're going to get homicidal or suicidal. It's just that is the sort of situation that if you try to reconstruct this, you know, these people always do have more, absolutely more stress in their life and absolutely are always facing the actual loss or the potential loss of something very important. All right. So why would a restraining order set him off? Because it's really the court system has signed on to the idea, too, you know, that he can't have access to his family. Well, again, in Wisconsin, the court system doesn't do that randomly. It doesn't, you know, maybe we have a judge or two who might, but most of the judges are going to be very careful about separating families. So something was going on here that the judicial system said, yeah, this guy should be separated from not only his family, but from his firearms. So a restraining order was one more thing saying that, you know, life was not going to go the way he wanted it to go, for sure. And then why does he go to her work? I know most of us don't think about this, but, I don't want to scare anybody, but we're vulnerable at work in a way. If you had to choose a place where you were going to hide and be able to take care of yourself, would you choose that at home or work? And most of us would say home because we know our home's better. We know we have access to the whole thing. And so we're workplaces are meant to be open, right? They're meant to have walk-in customers. This is a spa where you're supposed to be able to probably, you know, walk in. So there's a vulnerability there. Also, you know, when are you home? Well, you probably don't have an exact schedule as to when you're going to be home. So if you actually know somebody's schedule and you know that they're a devoted worker, and that is the report in the media that she was a very hardworking mother, and so he knew she would be there. So, you know, if you're going to hurt somebody, that's where you might go. And then this next question, do they really want to hurt others, or do they just get in the way of the bullets like he was a bad shot? I mean, that's a good question. That one you'd actually have to know, you know, both his capacity with firearms, and you'd have to know, you know, how wild the situation got, which we may know down the road when more of the people who were in the spa are able to give information. I did want to say at the top of this before answering this question, even if we get like some these questions, even if we get some kind of perfectly like an answer that all of the scientists who study suicide and study homicide and study domestic violence, even if I give an answer that is perfectly correct according to all of their research findings, it's still anything I say here is going to be not very satisfying because, you know, we have a couple kids out here with who've lost at least one parent, and we don't know. I mean, it's not out yet in the media how the mom, who was the intended victim of all of this for sure, apparently, we don't know yet, or maybe others do. I don't know. I guess I'll put it that way, whether she survived this shooting. So, you know, answers help, but they are not, you know, they're not going to bring anybody back, right? So, all right, so let me make sure. So was he just a bad shot, or did he really mean to hurt others? I think that's a question I'm on. And that, again, that one, as I started to say, that's pretty particular to this situation. You know, was he actually trying to hurt other people, or did it? Would he have been satisfied with just murdering his wife? I don't know. That's a hard one to know. There was a report that he left the building going after somebody, and that suggests that there was more than one intended victim. Who knows, that there may have been a personal relationship with the person that was leaving. I don't know, or maybe he was intending to have everybody at work go down. That's hard to know. Sometimes workplaces are very supportive of women who are facing these kinds of things, and you know, that's the right thing to do. That may have meant that he was also angry and would have been able to control her more, you know, if she hadn't had the support of people, which, you know, that's a real catch-22. You don't want anybody at work hurt on the one hand, and you also don't want to let bullies get away with anything, right? So I don't know. I mean, generally, people, I would say if I had to come down on one side or the other, was he actually trying to hurt other people? Maybe if he specifically thought that her workplace was particularly supportive and therefore, in quotes, at in the wrong, because if they hadn't been, she would have been more she would have been more helpless and easier to control and all of that kind of stuff. The domestic violence stuff, almost always there's an intent to control somebody. Why? You know, I don't know. It's not because control is not a part of love, that's for sure. I think generally with domestic violence, people, instead of moving in the direction of actually doing the really, really hard work of love, they just don't have any hope, really, that that's going to work. And so they settle for control. They just settle for trying to control somebody as opposed to becoming lovable, becoming somebody that someone freely gives their love to and all of that. So I don't know if he was a bad shot or if he was really intending to hurt more people. Do people like this ever think of what it will do to the kids? Yeah, they actually do, and there's part of the problem. Sometimes in murder-suicides, one of the reasons the kids do end up getting killed is that the shooter or the murderer, whatever language you want to use, sometimes they think in terms of, you know, they don't want to leave the kids behind to deal, I guess, with what they will have to deal with. So they don't give the kids a choice on that one, which, again, we can all stand in judgment about how selfish that is, and that's certainly the direction I would lean as a human being just doesn't help us stop much of this kind of stuff. And then let's move into this one. Do people like the shooter have a plan? Let's see. I don't quite get this. Let me read it again. Do people like the shooter have a plan, like going to kill my wife and kill self? Yes. I would say they usually have some. I mean, this sometimes this is, you know, total random, you know, just happened, you know, to go that way. But generally, you know, there's a plan. And how do we know that? Well, you need ammunition. You need to get your gun. You need to, I think he took a cab. And they found his car, I think, and then they figured, I think somebody reported that they think he took his cab, right, because his car, maybe his wife would have recognized, so getting out of a cab, you know, gave him a little extra time probably to get into the building. So you can see there's planning involved in all of that. And why not just kill yourself? I mean, the people who study homicide and suicide diverge on this. Some of them see homicide and suicide as exactly the same thing. It's an aggression, and it's, you know, it's a way to, you know, it's a way to solve a problem, and the way to solve the problem is to imagine that the person is the problem as opposed to something else, and so you solve the problem by getting rid of the person, either your wife, you know, and yourself. In fact, there's a line of research in suicide, in fact, where the researchers try to figure out who is the intended victim of the suicide. And by that, I mean that there's enough known about suicide to say when somebody commits suicide, especially when there's a lot of anger in it, they often are intending for a particular person to be most hurt by their death. In other words, I know this is sort of convoluted thinking, but hang in there with me. In other words, their suicide is their way of murdering somebody that is important to the intended victim of the suicide, if that makes sense. So that's not unusual, for instance, like when there's a breakup and somebody commits suicide, sometimes they leave a note and they're trying to have the person who broke up with them feel guilty about the breakup. Okay. I want to make sure that I get... All right, so the one thing that I want to say is that mostly what this says is that, to me, as a psychologist, is that we need to spend much more time thinking about what do we do, you know, in our own families and in our culture around conflict. We have to figure out, well, there's a saying that, you know, you learn conflict management at home. You know, you learn hate at home. You don't learn anger at home, but you certainly learn what are we supposed to do with anger at home. And, you know, people learn peace at home. Peace is learned. It's not something that, you know, comes out of us. So, you know, what do we do about this as a community and as a culture? Well, I mean, besides the supporting, I think one of the things that were really some of the most beautiful reports that came out of this event were the families, you know, from the Sikh temple that were just, and they had their own version of this, 6-8 weeks ago in August. I don't recall the exact date, but it was early August. And then some of the families came right out to Brookfield to be with people, and I thought that was beautiful. Most of these things always do get back to love. You know, gets back to people learning, you know, figuring out, you know, how to live their lives, not focused, you know, on controlling people, but focused on loving people, not focused on trying to, really, it's just not settle for controlling somebody. You know, really learning how to love and really learning how to live in a in a collaborative, healthy, interacting way with people who are different from us and people who don't share our exact values. And, you know, I think, you know, we really need to get serious about the fact that peace, you know, abuse is learned at home and so is peace. I guess I can put it that way. So, you know, that's about all we can do in a situation like this. Probably in the next few days there will be questions about, you know, as there should be, in my opinion, you know, about was the mental health profession involved here? Did, you know, did anybody get a referral to talk with this guy and help him out? And I can tell you, even in situations, even if there was, were some mental health professional is involved, these are pretty volatile situations, and, you know, hopefully, you know, they would have known how to use the, you know, how to use police and how to use legal action. And honestly, usually that does make a big difference. It's just when someone is really pushed to the brink, and not necessarily from the outside, but from the inside, when they don't see that there's much of a reason, you know, to keep trying to work within the system, they really do go outside the system. So, and this is about as far outside the system as we can get, right? So I thought maybe one thing that I could do with this is to maybe just try to describe kind of psychologically what's going on with someone who can end up in this direction. It doesn't mean that everybody's got this going on would ever end up with this kind of extreme outcome, which has happened here over the weekend. But that these are things, I think, to watch for, you know, in other people, in yourself, in your children. You just don't want very much of this in you at all, and you don't want to be in relationships with people who have a lot of this kind of stuff in them. And you don't want to, you know, if you see this in your children, you need to work heartily in the direction of really helping them learn about healthy collaborative living with people who are different from themselves. So abusers, usually domestic abusers, domestic violence, these are things that they have in common. There's, as I said before, there's a focus, you know, on control as opposed to love. The kind of power that they prefer is called dominance. You know, instead of becoming more capable of discussion and talking and collaborating, they get their way by dominating. In other words, they don't skill build except around the areas of control. They don't, you know, they don't learn how to influence people through language and conversation. They do it through dominance. They don't just see how the people who are different than them, they don't just see them as different. They see them as wrong, and they see themselves as not just having a good idea. They see themselves as having the only right idea. So, you know, again, be careful with that. And not always, but often there's a, you know, often these things, I mean, the fact that we know that the hometown police here were involved means that that this was definitely escalating. So the escalation usually starts with some verbal abuse, which is like criticism that's really harsh and very personal, and blame for things going wrong, like, oh, anything, you know, the water boils over, and instead of that just being, you know, somebody forgot for a moment to take care of something, it becomes, you know, a big blame thing. Lots of times there's a little paranoia in the picture, and people are accused of things that are just ridiculous, and that there's no basis for it. Or even if there is a basis, it's not a significant basis, I guess I'll just put it that way. And there's name-calling. I mean, you just want to keep name-calling out of the picture always if you possibly can. The other part of this that's always a little frightening is that whatever violence is in the picture, it just feels justified, and that the person feels justified in doing what they did, and that's always an extremely bad sign. I know I hit her, but she deserved it. You know, this, so you know, there's very little, is there generally, there's not a lot of insight into, like, you know, maybe I'm a part of the problem here. You know, my yelling or my throwing stuff or breaking stuff or my threatening is a part of the problem. Usually there's very little insight about that. Let's see, what else? I guess we'll put in one thing else. I mean, again, this is just a red flag. Accusing other people of stuff that is clearly stuff that's they do. In psychology, we call it projection. You know, I'm doing it, but I'm accusing you of doing it. So none of those are healthy indicators. And if you are doing any of that stuff, you want to work on it and really, you know, bring those things down to zero in your life. And if you're with somebody who's doing that, you want to be careful about that and see if they can, you know, get some help for that. And mental health treatment does help for that. It just, you know, it's not overnight, but, you know, not always, but often there is an abusive kind of life that somebody went through prior to getting into their adult life. And even when they're good in the workplace, which is pretty structured, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be skilled with human relationships. So, you know, that's just reality, that it's a whole skill set to learn how to deal with people who are different from us, who stop loving us. I think that's an extremely painful thing for human beings to deal with. And some people deal with it by going away and sobbing for 3 years, and other people deal with it by stalking and by not letting go and just sort of hanging on. And all of those things are a reflection of a kind of scarcity mentality, like there's not enough on the enough good people or good women or good men on the planet, and if I, you know, can't have this one, there's nobody for me. When in fact, really, there's a lot of love and plenty of love for all of us. You just have to be willing to say goodbye to the place where it isn't and look for the place where it is. All right. And then just a direct statement out to anybody who is listening who maybe has personal connection with the spa workers or the spa owner or the actual family that was involved here. We certainly can't, I'm sure most of us cannot imagine directly what these days, what yesterday was like and what these days are going to be like over the next few months and weeks. And as I said, I was very touched, as I'm sure many of us were, by the fact that the families from Oak Creek, from the Sikh community, were just instantly on the scene helping. I think, again, you know, that speaks to that actually speaks to something that was related to another question that I was going to try to get to. And maybe I will just sort of wrap these two together. The second question is about politics, and I think these are actually quite connected. The person starts this way: I've become a huge fan of yours. I don't live in Milwaukee, but one of my friends does, and she told me about your show. It's great. Anyway, I have a question that you might not want to answer, and if you don't, that's okay. It's about politics. Here's the question. Do you think we will always have this kind of anger around politics? At work, it can get really nasty and very uncomfortable. What can we do to make it better? No, I don't think we're always going to have this kind of anger around politics. I think we're in a stage, and I think we are in a stage where people don't quite know how to, be at peace with differences. I was thinking when I read this question that I know a friendship group, and I would say these are, let's say there are five couples, and they are, some are staunch Republicans, some are staunch Democrats, and I use the word staunch on purpose because, these are people who are, you know, put signs in their front yard and who campaign and who make calls and go door to door, and yet they came together, not through politics, but through family. Their children knew each other. They love the community that they're in. They like each other personally, and they will all go vote in a couple of weeks and cancel each other's votes out because they're probably all, I mean, there's probably about 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans in the group. And I think that's wonderful. And I, one of the things that I think will come of this, I just think as a culture, we're sort of in an adolescent phase, really. I think this whole sort of name-calling around, you know, liberal is the same as a cuss word, conservative is the same as a cuss word. What I'm hoping will happen is there will be more intelligent discussion that is based on really looking at what do we mean if we self-identify or identify another person as being a liberal or a conservative or a progressive. I do think that we are in a more complex time in human history. I think the connectivity means we are, on the one hand, more aware of some of these things, and on the other hand, doesn't mean just because we're aware, we exactly have come down on the side of what do we want to do with this stuff yet. I am going to recommend for any of you who are interested in more intelligent conversation, and that's, you know, if there's a workplace, I think this is especially useful. There's a TED video, T-E-D, TED like the name TED, like Ted Turner. And TED stands for, Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And there's a psychologist who studies the difference between, at a values level, at a morality level, the difference between conservatives and liberals. And here is perhaps this is good news, it's not a surprise to me at all, that we overlap in our values quite a bit. He says that one group has sort of 5 moral channels. He says think of morality channels a little like you might a sound engineer's board, right, where they're moving the control stick a little forward or back to get the exact right mix. And his research says that there are 5 broad things that people value, and that conservatives and liberals are actually aligned on 3 of those. And they, and even the 2 that they're not completely aligned on, they're still pretty, they're still not as different as they think they are. So, in other words, I think this friendship group that I described, of these couples who connected around the love of their community and connected around the love of their children, I think that's kind of what they're demonstrating is what's normal, which is that we're actually more connected than we believe we are. I do think that, you know, the smart money is on looking at how much fear is being sort of pushed into politics. I mean, generally, as bad as things get, we generally cope, and we'll probably keep coping, and we probably need to move things in whatever direction people think we should move them in. But I think dialogue is what has to happen. I think it's helpful to know that we're more together than we believe we are. So that we share more in common. So go look up, the psychologist's name is Jonathan Haidt, and I don't exactly know how to pronounce his name, even though I've heard him say it, but I don't remember it. But it's H-A-I-D-T, first name Jonathan. He's at the University of Virginia, or at least he used to be a year or two ago. I think he's still there. But he studies, among other things, he studies morality, and he is the person who discovered that there's a fair amount of overlap, and you can maybe debate where there's no overlap, but it might be nice to sort of celebrate the connection that we actually have as a culture. Certainly, maybe that's what would be nice to have, even in families where there's great great pain around people not being able to connect, and certainly we saw a huge example of that this weekend. All right, I think we'll call that a day. I'm Dr. Julie Helmrich. I'm a psychologist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I want to apologize again. There are a number of questions that we didn't get to, but I will get to those tomorrow. I just wanted to make sure that we got to all of the questions on the shooting episode that happened here over the weekend. As you know, you can write, you can go to the Facebook page of Shrink and Drink, click on Message. There's a box at the top that says Message, and you can write any question in. We thought this would be a call-in show, but it's turning out to be a digital version of what we do live here in Milwaukee at Key Wisconsin in Waukesha and at Cranky Al's in Wauwatosa and at Hamburger Mary's in Bayview, where people write questions anonymously on a piece of paper. I read them and answer them, and it's much like what we're doing right here today, except it's around 50, 60, 70, 90 questions in an hour and a half, so it's a little faster than this venue or this particular methodology. At any rate, come join us at a live event sometime in November. We will be, you can go to, you know what, I don't have those dates right off the top of my head. I know one of them, but not all of them. So they'll be on the Shrink and Drink Facebook page, and hope to see you live. And again, prayers to everybody who was affected. I was plenty of people, not just the people who were shot, but it will take many, many people a while to recover, which is what I'm certain that the people from Oak Creek who came by to help yesterday and probably are still in the picture, I'm sure they can attest to that. Generally, just to put a time frame on the worst events that people deal with that are more normal than this one, still take the typical human being a couple of years to get through. So if you know anybody who's directly affected, please be patient with them. It will take them a while to heal through all of what happened here yesterday. Again, I'm Dr. Julie Helmrich. I'm a psychologist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Have a good rest of your day.